accession number 18475, Reel 6.
Arnold Baldwin, Reel 6. You were saying he praised the German surgeon.
Yes, he, as I said, he was walking with a limp, a quite pronounced limp, but he did feel that the skill of the German surgeon had prevented an amputation, so he was at least grateful for that. Shortly after that, somebody came into the house where we were and said that he was a paratroop. And he said that his CO, to whom we'd been seconded, had said we had to move up the street and he would take us to another house we were to occupy. So we went with him and went into this house. We were then told that one of us had to be in charge of the group, as it were, and go across to see their CO for instructions and so on. And, well, there were at least two of us of equal rank. There could have been a third, I'm not sure. But we decided that somebody had to do it, so they gave me the job. I went across to see the CO. I was told that water was now at a premium, and they had, fortunately, they'd had the foresight to fill a bath at the top of the house with water, which we could draw on for drinking purposes only, no other use. It meant just charging from our house. We'd been moved into this one higher up the road, which was much closer to the what are called the MDS crossroads. And the building that we were put into was next door to another hotel which had been taken over as a field dressing station, the Rewick Hotel. And we were, there was an empty yard and then our house. So we were quite close to this crossroads and quite close to this hospital. Nothing much happened at first. But finally I was told to go across. A runner came over from the wounded officer, and he turned out to be wounded. I had to go and see him, and he was laying on a couch in a ground floor room covered with a blanket. How severely he'd been wounded, I don't know, or why he was there and not in the hospital, I can't understand quite, but perhaps he refused to go. Anyway, when we moved into this house next door to the Vreewijk Hotel, an exploration of the house showed us that when we went to, we could see nothing from the ground floor at all. The windows were set very high in the walls on the ground floor. They were more or less for ventilation, I think. You couldn't see through them, they were much too high. So that it was only from the first and second floors that you could see any of your surroundings at all. The house had a very heavy pair of front doors, which of course we kept securely bolted. And we then posted sentries on each floor where we had the best viewpoint. Immediately behind our house was a small yard, and behind that a warehouse of some sort. It had the usual warehouse doors on each floor, a pair of doors used for loading and unloading goods and so on. And that was just a few yards from our back wall. We had a window. There was a small scullery in the very back room. This had a window. I don't think there was a door to the outside at that point. It was in a passageway off to one side. But right opposite us, we could see from that window, we could see this warehouse building. On the left, looking out of the window, a wall ran from the side of our building away to our left at right angles to us. And on the other side of this wall were again further gardens and allotments. It was all vegetable stuff anyway. And from there we could see the backs of the houses on the road that was running parallel with our road, but not quite parallel, but at an angle to it. And we could see people moving about in those rooms. And eventually we discovered they were Germans, but at first we didn't know who the heck was in them. Nothing much happened on the first day or so that we were in this house. We went looking for food. We'd run out of food. We'd got nothing. Our emergency rations were gone. It was just nothing we'd got. So a search of the building we were occupying, we found that most of the furniture had been cleared away. Whether the Germans had looted it before we got there or whether the Dutch people were able to flee with it, I have no idea. But it was empty of furniture and consequently blankets and things of that sort. After we'd been there a little while, a runner came over from the Paris headquarters. I had to go and report to the major there. Well, I say major, I'm not sure. I never saw his rank and I never knew his name. Well, we spent the first and second nights in this hotel with nothing very much to do. But on the following morning, there was a tremendous outburst of firing somewhere, I felt, up by the crossroads. Very heavy firing. And not long after that, there was a furious banging on our front door. I was rather reluctant to open the door to anyone, but well, at this furious banging on the door, I was hesitant about opening it until a voice that no German could have imitated said in really raucous Cockney, "Come on, open up for fuck's sake. It's fucking naughty out here." This, of course, was shortly after this fusillade of fire that we'd heard. So, of course, I opened up. And a para came in. He was wearing either a camouflage net or a neckerchief or something around his head. He looked rather like a pirate more than anything else. And he said, "Christ, it's bloody naughty out there." I said, "Well, I should imagine it is. What the hell were you doing up there?" He said, "Well, nobody tells you anything." He said, "Nobody knows anything. We don't know what's going on, what's happening or anything." He said, "So I decided to go and have a look for myself." So he'd left the house that was more or less opposite us, I assume, and gone up to the crossroads. And, of course, it was German fire that he'd come under. And he was extremely lucky to have escaped, really. Anyway, after having a bit of a chat, he just wandered off across the road again. And we settled down to a quieter vigil, watching out of the first and second floor windows across to the houses that were on the other side of these allotments again. We were still a little bit confused as to who was what, but we strongly suspected they were German occupied. Not long after this, there was more banging on the front door. This time I remembered to challenge him in the traditional manner, "Who goes there?" And he said, "Captain someone or other, RAMC. I've come from the hospital." So I opened the door and let him in. And he said, "I've had a visit from the German commander. He said he's bloody annoyed with you people being in this house. And he's telling me that unless you vacate it, he will bring his tanks round the corner and he'll blast the place out, regardless of whether it damages the hospital or not. So you've got the option to get out or risk having the hospital blown up as well as the house you're in." So I said, "Well, I've strict instructions from the officer that I'm attached to that I mustn't leave this house under any circumstances. So I said, I think the best thing you can do is to come across the road with me and see this officer and tell him your story." So we went across the road. The same man was still laying on the settee. Again, I'm totally unaware of his name or rank. But the captain from the medical corps repeated his story as to what the Germans had said, that they would bring tanks round and blast them, blast us out. And this man, I don't know whether he was slightly not with it or what, but he said to this captain, "Oh, well, that's all right, we'll just knock all their tanks out. We'll just knock them out." So this RAMC captain, he was furious at this. He knew it was rubbish. He said, "Don't talk bloody daft." He said, "The Germans know damn well you've got no anti-tank ammunition of any sort." So my advice to you is to withdraw from that house and make sure that you're known to withdraw. So the wounded paraman said, "Well, okay." And as I turned to leave the room with the medical corps bloke, the officer motioned to me to remain behind. So off went the medic, and then this man said to me, "Right," he said, "now what I want you to do is to move out of that house into the one next door. Stay the night in the one next door, and the following day move back, following morning, move back into that same house again." So I said, "Okay." I went back and I reported this to the other lads who were beginning to get a bit fed up with things. I can't say that morale was particularly high at this stage. Anyway, we did, as he said, moved out into the house next door, and then the following morning we moved back into the house we've been told to clear out of. Well, as I said earlier, we had run out of food, and all we could discover in the way of food in this house, in the basement, were row upon row of bottled plums. The Dutch are great ones for preserving fruit and vegetables. And this particular house, it was all plums. And we'd been eating these wretched plums, which was all we really had for food. And the juice, of course, was a fair part of the liquid we were able to have. Anyway, I think this may have had some ill effects on me, because I've still got the men posted upstairs on different floors, keeping a watch across to the houses where we strongly suspected they were Germans. And presently, one of the lads came rushing up very excitedly, saying, "Here, I've found a meat tablet." It was this compressed meat stuff that you soaked in water and put on a Dixie and boiled up, and it made some sort of a stew. So I said, "Well, put the bloody thing on. We've got a Tommy cooker. And I said, "Well, we'll cook that up." Meantime, I was on the first floor with the other man, Bert Stroud, who was, as I said, I think, senior in age to all of us. And Bert and I were standing with our backs against the wall, opposite the window wall, looking across at one of these houses, and we suddenly saw a German helmet and face pressed up against the glass in one of these houses opposite. Now, we were told, frankly, I disobeyed an order here, but I think it was, as I say, partly I must have been a little bit mentally deranged, because I was so maddened by the sight of this bloody German that I said to Bert, "He's got to bloody go, Bert." And he said, "Yeah." And so we argued as to who should do it. I said, "Well, I'm going to." And I took aim, and sure enough, the face disappeared instantly, so I knew that the shot was accurate. Of course, that had consequences that, if I'd have had the full use of my brains, I think I would have realised must happen. Bert then went downstairs. They put the meat cube in a Dixie, and Bert took it downstairs with water and put it on a Tommy cooker in the basement. While he was guarding that, or preparing it rather, can you stop it a moment, please? Bert was, of course, in the basement cooking the stew, and rather stupidly, but understandably, as the smell of the stew began to percolate up through the house, those on watch at the windows on the first and second floors got the whiff of this. And in the end, we were all congregated on the ground floor at the head of the stairs to the basement, waiting for the stew. At this stage, one of the fellas walked through the small kitchen into the scullery where the window was into the yard, and he tiptoed back to me and whispered, "There's a Jerry looking through the window. What shall I do?" I couldn't think of anything brighter to say except shoot the bastard. But then we looked round, and we none of us had got a weapon with us. I think the smell of that stew had absolutely sabotaged our military sense altogether. Harry Crone, who'd looked at the through the window and seen this man, or he didn't look through the window, he saw him through the doorway. He had a bag with some grenades in it. And before I could stop him, he'd taken out a grenade, pulled the pin and lobbed it into this scullery. And all that was between us was a very light screen. I don't think it was much more than light timber and hardboard or something like this. And I thought, my God, when that goes off, I don't know what's going to happen. But fortunately, the screen withstood the explosion. The sound of the explosion was terrific in a confined space like that. Well, presently, I thought, I'll go and have a look. So I went out into the scullery very carefully, got to the side of the window where I could peer down without putting my face in the window onto the yard, which was between us and the warehouse, and there, lying on the paving just outside the window, was a German potato masher hand grenade. I thought, by God, if Harry hadn't walked out there at that very instant, it would have been curtains for us. It was quite surprising. Well, this really all stemmed from my stupidity in firing that round, because the Germans then knew that we were back in this building again, despite the fact that they'd said not. And I knew we were in trouble from there on. Well, not long after that, I got another call to go and see the officer in the Paris house across the road. And this time he said they were expecting a German attack with tanks. And we were to go, our mob from the house, about half a dozen of us, if that, we're to go across into the allotment area where all these old unused slit trenches were still there from previous occupation. We were to go there and keep a lookout up the road and disable these tanks as they approached us. Well, I thought, I do believe that the man is losing his buttons, because we'd only our rifles, and presumably Harry still had one or two grenades left, but how we were going to tackle tanks with that lot, I wasn't sure. Furthermore, what puzzled me was the fact that when he told me to return to that house the next day, under no circumstances leave it. And here he is telling me to leave the house, doesn't matter whether we still occupy it or not, and go and occupy the slit trenches in the allotment and look for some tanks. I thought, it's not making a lot of sense. And of course I ordered the blokes across the road and we spent some time in the slit trenches. During this time, we got our first full view of the Vreewijk Hotel, which was being used as a first aid station or hospital. And you could look across and see German motorcycle combinations arriving with wounded, taking them in. I won't make any names, but one of our members had, by this time, his morale had really gone, completely collapsed. And he made no effort at all to look out for any approaching tanks or anybody else for that matter. He was, quite frankly, simply, he was finished, as it were, and he was cowering down at the bottom of this slit trench. And for some reason, this enraged me. I wasn't at my best, I suppose, and I wasn't particularly considerate. And I kept calling out to him to stand up and keep watch. Although I knew the whole operation was futile anyway. And consequently, I kept walking across. I'd even stand by slit trench and say, for Christ's sake, get up, man. He got one other man in the slit trench with him. But he was shattered. It was no good. Well, fortunately, no tanks came, no German infantry or Germans at all, except these motorcycle combinations bringing their wounded in. And while I was wandering about trying to get this fella to stand up and keep a watch, one of these combinations was in the yard there in front of the hospital, and the motorcyclist came out, and we were not a hell of a lot of yards apart. And he stood looking at me, and I stood looking at him. I thought, this is absolutely bloody ridiculous, really. It just seemed that it was a fantasy almost. It didn't seem real. He finally turned away, I thought, with a look of disgust, as much as say, what can you do with stupid people like them? And got on his bike and rode away to fetch more people, or another person. Well, at this stage, morale was very low, and the lads began to say, well, why are we here? This is daft. And they were raising questions like, where are the paratroopers? Why is it always us? We've got to protect our house at all costs. Then we can abandon it and come over here. They're supposed to be in the house next door. Well, where are they? We see nothing of them. And a feeling of, well, I won't say mutiny, that's not the feeling at all. But a feeling of, shall I say, disbelief almost had overcome most of us, I think. And the chaps started to say, well, this is daft, let's go back. Well, I said, no, we can't go back. We're under orders to stay here. I became very conscious at this stage that if I gave the order to our blokes to go back, I was disobeying the order of the officer of the paras, and as a result, I could well be court-martialed for it, and I didn't fancy that. I thought, well, I'm the one who's got to carry the can, so I refused to sanction a move back. But eventually, I gave way. I said, oh, well, this is bloody stupid. So we all did troop back into our house. I knew that I had been under observation from the rear of the house where the officer was and some of his men. And sure enough, we hadn't been back in our